Welcome to the dsmith.org podcast for March 4th, 2006, a tribute to Andy Hish. I'm Doug Smith. So I have Michael King on the phone. He's going to be talking with us today about a great loss to the EMC industry. We've lost a great person recently who is in many ways a pioneer, well-known as gentleman's gentleman, and respected throughout the world. Michael King was a close personal friend and a colleague of Andy Hish's. And Andy and Michael King and Reynolds. Michael, what was the other person's name?
David Reynolds.
David Reynolds. The three of them and others were pioneers in the field of ESD. And pretty much everything we do today in that field derives from work that those people did. So, Michael, when did you first meet Andy Hish?
I met Andy originally approximately 1967 or 1968. We actually met at an IEEE symposium, I believe it was in Seattle. Andy was launching a new company and new receivers at the time for RF measurement. He was also advising with Stoddard Aircraft Radio Company, and in part of that, he had a whole lot of antennas that he was putting together associated with his new company. So Andy's original background was largely to do with high-frequency measurement.
Was he involved in ESD at that time?
No, not at all. Andy was one of the preeminent people involved in sensitive, very unique receivers. He was intensely involved in the design with a company by the name of the Dick Stoddard Aircraft Radio Company, a name which is being lost to antiquity at this moment. And Stoddard made radios, radio receivers, and antennas particularly directed toward the mil-spec industry.
About what year was that?
Stoddard was around in the mid-1950s. And continued into the early 70s, if I remember correctly.
What was the Stoddard Aircraft Radio Company?
Stoddard manufactured a whole line of receivers, and they would do it under commission to the what was in the tri-services of the military. There was no DOD at the time. So they would respond to government requests for unique bands, and they had several receivers. For example, the Navy Underwater Sound Laboratories needed something to work with magnetic detection of hulls and submarines, and so they had one that went audio frequency to about 30 kilohertz. But their main line of receivers went in various receiver units, individual receivers, not tuning units, from 10 kilohertz all the way up to about 1 gigahertz. One of the most fascinating things to me about the Stoddard Aircraft Radio Company is that though most of their receivers had military designations like AN/URM, the commercial versions of them were called NMs, which meant noise meters. One in particular that Andy worked with Al Parker, who was then chief engineer of Stoddard. Al Parker, by the way, was otherwise known as A.T. Parker, who went on to found Solar Instruments. Anyway, their receiver, the NM30A, if you look at the specifications for it and its quasi-peak detector function, you basically get a receiver whose specifications have been copied and used in all CISPAR International EMC measurements today. Even the Stoddard Aircraft Radio Company current probes, designed and built in the 1950s, are still manufactured. The company was acquired over a number of years by various other companies, but right now their current probes, in the design form that they originally made them, circa 1959, are produced by ETS Lindgren in Texas.
What was Andy's new company involved in producing?
In circa 1967, Andy and a group of people from Stoddard left Stoddard. Dick Stoddard had died about that time, if I remember correctly. And they decided to kick up the bandwidth above 1 gigahertz. So Andy founded a company called EMC Instrumentation, and they made a remarkable receiver. This thing went from 1 to 26 gigahertz in 1968. It was a scanning, Klysotron-based receiver, and it had a front-end sensitivity in 1968 of minus 104 dBm. It was an absolutely amazing instrument. It actually had a few things that were completely innovative at the time. For example, an automatic peak and hold detector system, so that if a peak transient or peak CW pulse came along, you could hold it in memory. Something that had never before been done before. It was just an amazing, amazing instrument. And in $1968, it was extremely expensive. It cost $60,000. But Andy basically dominated the market with that company.
Did he enter the ESA activity around then?
No, not at all. Singer Sewing Machine Company decided to go into the instrumentation business. And Stoddard had been working on what we now call Tempest work with the specifications that are also lost to antiquity, like NAGWA and AT-SECT, buzzwords that are never heard anymore. But Stoddard was acquired by Singer, and he sold EMC instrumentation to Singer, which used it as an expansion of their product line. So when Andy retired from that, he went on to form another company called AH Systems. If you ever look at an antenna company called AH Systems, that AH means Andy Hish. That's still in operation today. He sold it off to his partner that was in business with him at the time, and they make some very fine antennas. But it's interesting how many lives Andy touched with his various ideas and his expertise in radio frequency. This is just another example.
What motivated Andy to become involved in designing and manufacturing EST test equipment?
Well, I'm proud to say I had something to do with that. In 1972, the world's largest computer manufacturer at the time commissioned me to build a prototype and as a demonstration of a furniture ESD discharge test set and to show how it would work in large mainframe systems. So I built this monstrosity. It weighed about 500 pounds. It had a 100 kV, 10,000 watt power source, just in case I needed some real power behind it, because it was an experimental prototype. We didn't really know what ESD was at the time. However, it was fairly successful, and in 1974, a lot of people, including the original manufacturer, wanted a productionalized version of this thing. So Andy, who had left at that time AH Systems and formed yet a third company, Andy Hish Associates, he had been building, under Andy Hish Associates, various ancillary equipment for the radio frequency measurement industry. And it was a smaller company than the previous ones he had been involved with. And I thought it would be a good opportunity to introduce a new product line for him. So I called him to see if this rather small-scale production at the time, if he'd be interested in taking this 500-pound monstrosity I'd built one of and boiling it down into something that could be produced. And sure enough, using switching power supplies and high-voltage autoformers, he came up with this model called, if I remember correctly, it was a ESD 253. The 253 was 25, and the 3 meant kilovolts, so it was 25 kilovolts. But basically, it was a furniture discharge simulator about the size of a machinist toolbox. And it was produced rather widely for quite a number of years. In about 1978, though, Digital Equipment Corporation had come up with yet another idea about how ESD should be done, and this introduced me to a person by the name of David Reynolds. David Reynolds and I went off to try to reconcile differences between Andy Hish's test set and the incorporate box that Digital Equipment Corporation was using. And we found some fairly remarkable things, that absolutely nobody understood what the waveforms of ESD really were. So David and I put about 4 man-years into studying this in various ways and changed the state of the art in terms of information. Then we had to go find out somebody to go build a test set. So we contacted a number of people, including Andy Hish, to see about building test sets to what we had then identified as new waveforms. And something absolutely amazing happened. After several years, from 1977, 78 to about 1980, we weren't getting very far, because we had discovered that ESD rise times change rather dramatically with amplitude. At 2 kV and 4 kV, you could get 200 picosecond rise times. At 10 kV, you'd get 1 nanosecond, 4 nanosecond, 20 nanosecond rise times. At 8 kV, you'd get reliable 1 nanosecond rise times. So because we discovered that there was this bandwidth amplitude dependency, amplitude being ESD, we had this phenomenal problem that it wasn't a standard RC network. It was a cascaded line that William Byrne, a theoretical physicist with Southwest Research Institute, had also proven about the same time. So we were trying to find somebody to build our test set that would actually look like a real human being. And Andy came up with a prototype around 1980 that was absolutely phenomenal.
How was the new ESD test generator unique?
Well, basically, it was a human replicant. When David and I measured it for the first time in a DEC Digital Equipment Corporation facility in Colorado, we were just flabbergasted.
About what day, what year was that?
This was 1980. In fact, it was October of 1980. I remember it vividly. You could set this machine to 8 kV, and you'd get a human waveform as if a human had discharged it at 8 kV. If you set it to 2 kV, you'd get a 200 picosecond waveform exactly the way it would come from humans. If you set it to 10 kV, you'd get a 4 nanosecond rise time. It would drift in its waveform with proportion to the amplitude changes just the way a human being would execute it in the real world. We were just astounded how accurate this thing was in replication of human beings. Digital Equipment Corporation did an unpublished study for 1 year where they actually took human beings in controlled environment chambers and discharged them to systems at various amplitudes, known amplitudes, charging people to known amplitudes, discharging them to systems to get thresholds of failures. And then he would take Andy's test set and do the same thing, and they would never get deviations more than about 20%. It was just phenomenal.
That's pretty impressive. How did he do that in his design?
Well, actually, it came from his experience in microwaves. The measurement receiver that he had developed under his company EMC Instrumentation that went from 1 to 26 gigahertz, he had a fairly remarkable idea, another innovation of Andy's. In order to keep, because this thing was a scanning Klesitron receiver, in order to keep the IF gain stabilized, Andy himself developed an impulse generator. And every once in a while, because he had this peak and hole detector designed into the system, he could burp the impulse generator and use it as a metrology standard to adjust the IF gain of the receiver, giving a generally flat response. Andy's impulse generator, from a frequency range of 1 to 26 gigahertz, would be flat within plus or minus about 1 dB. And Andy basically took that idea that he had in a mismatched transmission line where he charged a transmission line and dumped it quickly. He took that idea that he used in those impulse generators, and that's how he got a 200 picosecond rise time using a larger version suitable for 25 kV probe that he developed in his new test set. But it was all because he actually knew how to do that with microwave impulse generators.
So, Michael, what eventually happened to this test methodology that he was so instrumental in developing?
Well, by about 1988, because the international standards were very weak at the time, and Andy's test generator, as he called it, was very widely used. I did a little trace. In 1988, 760 corporations were using that test set as their reference standard. It had become, in effect, a de facto standard in the United States. And the reason why that happened was Digital Equipment Corporation, Texas Instruments, Hewlett-Packard, Burroughs Corporation, numbers of big companies had written it into their corporate standards, and therefore all their vendors got it, and their vendors' vendors got it, and their peripheral vendors got it, and so on, and it just took off and had a world of its own. And what happened to the methodology was basically committees. The IEEE got involved in, I'm sorry, the IEC got involved in this, and set up a new standard that said that waveform should be more stabilized, waveform should be more standardized. And the result was everyone was forced to comply to the new standard. And this took off pretty much in the early 1990s. The result of that was the phenomenal machine that Andy had developed that replicated human beings was left to the dustbins in favor of doing what committees wanted to do in international standards. I would have to say, though, that if you really wanted to replicate ESD today, you'd do very well to go find yourself an old Andy Hish test set, because it is far superior in replicating the real world of ESD in nature compared to what the international standards test sets do.
Well, that's a great story, Michael, and a fitting tribute to Andy Hish. Thank you very much for your time.
You're entirely welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.